Saturn Rising, first published in the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, March 1961, collected in Tales of Ten Worlds.
Little did I imagine when I wrote this story in 1960 that within less than two decades, the fantastically successful Voyager missions to the outer solar system would reveal that the rings of Saturn were far more complex and beautiful than anyone had ever dreamed. The story has, of course, been dated by the scientific discoveries of the last four decades. In particular, we now know that Titan does not have a predominantly methane atmosphere, but one which is mostly nitrogen. There is another error which I might have corrected at the time. Even if you could observe Saturn from the surface of Titan, which atmospheric haze will probably prevent, you'd never see it rising. Almost certainly, Titan, like our own moon, has had its rotation tidally braked, so that it always keeps the same face turned toward its primary. So Saturn remains fixed in Titan's sky, just as the Earth does in the moon's.
Yes, that's perfectly true. I met Morris Perlman when I was about 28. I met thousands of people in those days, from presidents downward. When we got back from Saturn, everybody wanted to see us, and about half the crew took off on lecture tours. I've always enjoyed talking. Don't say you haven't noticed it. But some of my colleagues said they'd rather go to Pluto than to face another audience. Some of them did. My beat was the Midwest, and the first time I ran into Mr. Perlman, no one ever called him anything else, certainly never Morris, was in Chicago. The agency always booked me into good but not too luxurious hotels. That suited me. I liked to stay in places where I could come and go as I pleased without running a gauntlet of liveried flunkies, and where I could wear anything within reason without being made to feel a tramp. I see you're grinning. Well, I was only a kid then, and a lot of things have changed. It's all a long time ago now, but I must have been lecturing at the university. At any rate, I remember being disappointed because they couldn't show me the place where Fermi started the first atomic pile. They said that the building had been pulled down 40 years before, and there was only a plaque to mark the spot. I stood looking at it for a while, thinking of all that had happened since that far-off day in 1942. I'd been born, for one thing, and atomic power had taken me out to Saturn and back. That was probably something that Fermi and company never thought of when they built their primitive latticework of uranium and graphite. I was having breakfast in the coffee shop when a slightly built, middle-aged man dropped into the seat on the other side of the table. He nodded a polite good morning and then gave a start of surprise as he recognized me. Of course, he'd planned the encounter, but I didn't know it at the time. "This is a pleasure," he said. "I was at your lecture last night. How I envied you." I gave a rather forced smile. I'm never very sociable at breakfast, and I'd learned to be on my guard against the cranks, bores, and enthusiasts who seemed to regard me as their legitimate prey. Mr. Perlman, however, was not a bore, though he was certainly an enthusiast, and I suppose you could call him a crank. He looked like any average, fairly prosperous businessman, and I assumed that he was a guest like myself. The fact that he had attended my lecture was not surprising. It had been a popular one, open to the public, and of course well advertised over press and radio. "Ever since I was a kid," said my uninvited companion, "Saturn has fascinated me. I know exactly when and how it all started. I must have been about 10 years old when I came across those wonderful paintings of Chesley Bonestell's, showing the planet as it would look from its 9 moons. I suppose you've seen them." "Of course," I answered. "Though they're half a century old, no one's beaten them yet. We had a couple aboard the Endeavour, pinned on the plotting table. I often used to look at the pictures and then compare them with the real thing." "Then you know how I felt back in the 1950s. I used to sit for hours trying to grasp the fact that this incredible object, with its silver rings spinning around it, wasn't just some artist's dream, but actually existed. That it was a world, in fact, 10 times the size of Earth. At that time, I never imagined that I could see this wonderful thing for myself. I took it for granted that only the astronomers with their giant telescopes could ever look at such sights. But then, when I was about 15, I made another discovery, so exciting that I could hardly believe it. "And what was that?" I asked. By now I'd become reconciled to sharing breakfast. My companion seemed a harmless enough character, and there was something quite endearing about his obvious enthusiasm. "I found that any fool could make a high-powered astronomical telescope in his own kitchen for a few dollars and a couple of weeks' work. It was a revelation. Like thousands of other kids, I borrowed a copy of Ingalls Amateur Telescope Making from the public library and went ahead. Tell me, have you ever built a telescope of your own?" "No, I'm an engineer, not an astronomer. I wouldn't know how to begin the job." "It's incredibly simple, if you follow the rules. You start with two discs of glass, about an inch thick. I got mine for 50 cents from a ship chandler's. They were porthole glasses that were no use because they'd been chipped around the edges. Then you cement one disc to some flat, firm surface. I used an old barrel standing on end. Next, you have to buy several grades of emery powder, starting from coarse, gritty stuff and working down to the finest that's made. You lay a pinch of the coarsest powder between the two discs and start rubbing the upper one back and forth with regular strokes. As you do so, you slowly circle around the job. You see what happens? The upper disc gets hollowed out by the cutting action of the emery powder, and as you walk around it, it shapes itself into a concave spherical surface. From time to time, you have to change to a finer grade of powder and make some simple optical tests to check that your curve's right. Later still, you drop the emery and switch to rouge until, at last, you have a smooth, polished surface that you can hardly credit you've made yourself. There's only one more step, though that's a little tricky. You still have to silver the mirror and turn it into a good reflector. This means getting some chemicals made up at the drugstore and doing exactly what the book says. I can still remember the kick I got when the silver film began to spread like magic across the face of my little mirror. It wasn't perfect, but it was good enough, and I wouldn't have swapped it for anything on Mount Palomar. I fixed it at one end of a wooden plank. There was no need to bother about a telescope tube, though I put a couple of feet of cardboard around the mirror to cut out stray light. For an eyepiece, I used a small magnifying glass I'd picked up in a junk store for a few cents. Altogether, I don't suppose the telescope cost more than $5, though that was a lot of money to me when I was a kid. We were living then in a run-down hotel my family owned on 3rd Avenue. When I'd assembled the telescope, I went up on the roof and tried it out, among the jungle of TV antennas that covered every building in those days. It took me a while to get the mirror and eyepiece lined up, but I hadn't made any mistakes, and the thing worked. As an optical instrument, it was probably lousy. After all, it was my first attempt. But it magnified at least 50 times, and I could hardly wait until nightfall to try it on the stars.